Welcome, everybody, to tonight's satsang. And I always like to begin by quoting my guru, Swami Muktananda, who always began his programs by saying in Hindi, Sabko bade sanmane ke sath prem se hrdik swagat. With great respect and love, I welcome you all with all my heart. And he used to say that was his religion, to welcome another person with love. He didn't need to worship a deity. The deity that he worshiped was the human being, because the spark of God is in every person. So in that spirit, I want to welcome you. And also welcome our people watching on the global satsang on the internet. We have New York and Ann Arbor, and also Swami Bhagavananda again from Illinois, and our friends in Canada and in Japan. And I want to mention the new Adelaide Center, Dai Devi, Janavi, and Maruti, watching, and welcome. And Suri is also watching. So, and then Blue Mountains, Brisbane, Byron Bay, Oya, Aloha, Shamala, and Arun, and Bhaktiji is watching on Gold Coast. And I don't have Jyoti listed, but our hearts, our prayers are with Jyoti. She'll probably watch this at a later hour, so I want to say hello to Jyoti. And she's undergoing surgery on Monday. So is she here?
I
don't have it on the...
I don't have it either.
Ah, she might have gotten on a pirate one. which camera do I look at to say hello to her?
That one?
Hi, Jyoti.
Hi.
Okay, so tonight, as you know, that I always celebrate the great beings, and those who've attained the self, those who've attained self-realization or enlightenment, sometimes called Satori or Nirvana, different paths. And it's interesting, if you know about different yogic paths and meditative paths, whether they're Buddhist or Hindu or others, the goal is always the same, and they articulate it in different ways. And it's interesting because it shows the compassion of God, because people understand it in different ways. And sometimes one tradition speaks to a person and another tradition doesn't speak to a person. And so they're very interesting. So I always celebrate the great beings of all the traditions. And tonight we're going to look at one of my favorite traditions. And this is Suzuki Roshi, great Zen master who we've met many times before. Suzuki Roshi was born in Japan, and he went to the United States in 1959, and he opened a Zen center in California, and he gave great teachings, and a lot of people were attracted to him. Until his death in, I think, 1971. And we have several books of his lectures on Zen. Zen's a very interesting form of Buddhism. What else do we have? I love this aspect of Zen. Who would you like to be in this picture? So the Roshi goes around, and if anybody is wool gathering or moving, he sort of bows to them, and they bow to him, and then he hits them, and then they thank him, and he thanks them, and he moves on. So it's a very strict path. They're doing what's called a seshin, which is a long, many-day meditation, and they're practicing zazen, which is the Zen meditation. I love the concept of Zen meditation, because they call it just sitting. There's no particular technique or anything, or there's nowhere to go, nothing to strive for. You just sit. It's a wonderful kind of meditation. And as you sit, you just be with whatever arises. Whatever arises in thought or feeling, you just calmly be with it and you just watch the breath. And it's a great meditation. You're not striving for anything. In fact, one of the most wonderful ideas of Zazen is that what you're doing is replicating the Buddha's posture. You're sitting, and as you sit, you become the Buddha. The Buddha sat, and you're sitting too. He was just sitting, and you're just sitting. And there's nothing to attain aside from assuming that posture. And when you sit, you become the Buddha. There's nothing more to do. Just sit and be the Buddha. So it's a wonderful conception if you like it. It also, Dogen Zenji, who is the founder of the line of Soto Zen that, do we have another one? Is that it? Okay. Of Suzuki Roshi, says that Zazen is a state of brightly alert attention. Brightly alert attention, free of thoughts, directed to no object, and attached to no particular content. That give you an idea?
I have to go sit over there.
Okay, sit over there. Will you sit Zazen over there?
Yes.
Okay.
It's too hot under the lights. It's really hot.
The white hot spotlight. So Zen is a form of Buddhism that came to China. It was called Chan. And then Dogen Zenji went to China and learned there and then brought it back to Japan, where it became Zen. And the historians say that there was one figure around the year 500 who came from where? India. Of course. His name was Bodhidharma. And the Buddhists say that Bodhidharma brought the Dharma from India to China. He taught Zazen. He stressed sitting and direct experience. And he was known for four slogans, they call it. And I think it's worth mentioning those again. One, a special transmission outside the scriptures. So you see, it's not based primarily on scriptures. Scriptures might be helpful. Scriptures are wonderful, but there's something more to the real path, and we know that this is true. And it means that you can only practice real Zen with a master. So all the Zen stories you ever read are always about the guru and disciple. They're always a master doing some weird and unusual thing to a disciple and blowing his mind, hitting him or doing something weird and... exactly. Unexpected. And so they think that this transmission goes back to the Buddha. So you can see the parallel to our Shaktipat tradition. That goes back, the Buddha gave the teaching, not wrote in a book, but gave the teaching directly to an actual disciple, and that disciple gave the teaching to his disciple, and it's come down an unbroken line. What's the joke, kids? That what?
The Buddha and Upasani Maharaj knew each other.
Yes, that sounds like a New Yorker cartoon.
It was very interesting. You had to make this one.
Okay.
It was funny at the time.
What?
It was funny at the time.
It was funny at the time. It must have been a wonderful meeting.
Okay.
All right. So special transmission outside the scriptures. In other words, a direct transmission, not just dogmatic or doctrinal. Then related to that second one is no dependence on words or letters. So the idea is that reality is beyond words. Zen masters hate abstractions and theology. You know, there are a lot of paths that are full of theology, books and volumes of theological niceties. Zen doesn't like that. If you start talking theology, philosophy to a Zen master, he'll hit you with his stick. So even the concept you have of the Buddha or the path is an obstacle in Zen. And the third one related to that is the direct pointing at the mind, which means it's based on direct experience. You can see how these are all parallel to the yogic point of view. It's all about direct experience. And then finally, the fourth one, seeing into one's nature and the attainment of Buddhahood. That's pretty good, isn't it? And the idea being that what they call the Buddha nature, which we would call the self, but they would never call it the self. So if you're with a Buddhist, you don't say self, you say Buddha nature. Then they're happy, right? So you say Buddha nature is our true nature. So in the most real sense, we are one with the Buddha, that everyone has the Buddha mind or Buddha nature. So these are the four slogans associated with Bodhidharma, who brought the Dharma to China. So now some different teachings from Suzuki Roshi, and we'll see if we can make any sense whatsoever out of it, and see if we can translate it into our own terms. Student asks, I have some trouble with the lecture that you gave the other night. I'd like you to say one more thing about it, but I don't know what. You know, many people are puzzled by Zen talk. In fact, it's supposed to puzzle you. I can't quite see what it's all about. I do understand what it's about when you're talking about opposite and things like that. So that's a very candid question, isn't it? And then Suzuki Roshi, unlike some of Zen teachers, didn't want to obfuscate or confuse. He wanted to illuminate. That's one of the great things about him. I've met some so-called Zen masters in my life who were professional obfuscators, which meant that they talked Zen. See, even though Zen wants to be free of all dogma, inevitably, see, because there's an irony in all these things. Whatever you try hard to avoid, you generally fall victim to in the end. And so some of the lesser ones become victim of Zen style. And so they adopt a certain Zen persona, and so it defeats the purpose, really. But Suzuki Roshi is not like that. He says, the purpose of what I'm saying is to open a different approach to your understanding of reality. Now that right away is a very interesting thing, because one thing that Baba did for me is he opened a new way of thinking about things, a new understanding that was outside my possibility, created new possibilities. So he says, you're observing things from just one side or the other, and you stick to some one-sided understanding. That's why I'm talking this way. It's necessary. So he's saying that he's giving paradoxical teachings to shake us out of positionality, whatever position. Politically, you might be a left-winger or a right-winger. And the left-wingers think that the left-wing way of looking at things is not only a good way, it's the truth. And the right-wingers think that the right-wing way of looking at things is not only a good way, it's the truth. And Suzuki Roshi would say, now you look this way, then you look this way. And neither is the truth. He says, strictly speaking, Buddhists have no teaching. Buddhists have no teaching. I love that. It's just completely free and present. We have no God or deities. We don't have anything. Of course, that's not all forms of Buddhism are like that. What we have is nothingness, that's all. What did Bhagavan Nityananda say? It's all dust. That was his most real statement. It's all dust. So that's what he's saying, there's nothing. So how is it possible for Buddhists to be religious? You can only be religious if you have some deities or something. What kind of... So that will be the question. The answer is not some special idea of God or a deity, but rather the understanding of the reality we're always facing. Where are we? What are we doing? Who is he? Who is she? When we observe things in this way, we don't need a special teaching about God because everything is God for us. Moment after moment, we are facing God. And each one of us is also God or Buddha. So we don't need any special idea of God. That may be the point. I love that. That's the point. He says, that may be the point. Not sure, but... So what's he saying? What's he saying? He's addressing the mind, saying, don't be locked in to a particular point of view. And also, live your life fully, fully present. Live very intensely, now, without concepts, but be here. This is a longer lecture from him. And he says, and this is a very mysterious Zen-like piece. If you want to understand Buddhism, it's necessary for you to forget all your preconceived ideas. You could say that if you want to know God, you have to let go of all your preconceived ideas. Whatever you think of God, limit God. So you have to be open to whatever the experience is. He says, to begin with, you must give up the idea of substantiality or existence. The usual view of life is firmly rooted in the idea of existence. For most people, everything exists. They think whatever they see and whatever they hear exists. Of course, the bird we see and hear exists. It exists, but what I mean by that may not be exactly what you mean. The Buddhist understanding of life includes both existence and non-existence. What does this remind you of in our frame of reference, or your frame of reference? What's he getting at there? Do you get something from that? Think of Vedanta. What does Vedanta say? It's all an illusion. It's all an illusion. He says, the bird both exists and does not exist at the same time. We say that a view of life based on existence alone is heretical. That's a funny word, isn't it? If you take things too seriously, as if they existed substantially or permanently, you're called a heretic. Most people may be heretics. So what is he evoking here? If your mind is too locked into physical reality, if your mind is just mundane and taking everything at face value, he'd say you're a heretic. So in our terms, what we have to do is wash our mind in higher consciousness. It's not just mundane reality, but there's some higher truth that we can contact. We call it the Shakti, or the spirit, or the self. So, he says, we say true existence comes from emptiness and goes back again into emptiness. As Kashmir Shavan says, it comes from consciousness and goes back again into consciousness. What appears from emptiness is true existence. We have to go through the gate of emptiness. We have to go through the gate of emptiness. We have to deconstruct all of our wrong understandings. This idea of existence is very difficult to explain. Many people these days have begun to feel, at least intellectually, the emptiness of the modern world, or the self-contradiction of their culture. So I know that that was part of the crisis that I went through before I went to India in the 60s, of being successively disappointed by different ambitions and goals that I had. And each one I had high hopes for as I started, and then I'd say, oh, you know, that's not really it. And I was really idealistic enough to say, I want something that has some meaning. I didn't want anything that just to be follow an empty path. So he says, in the past, for instance, the Japanese people had a firm confidence in the permanent existence of their culture and their traditional way of life. But since they lost the war, they've become very skeptical. Very interesting cultural thing, that they believed in the emperor and all of that and so on. And then they lost the war, they became disenchanted. You know, when you throw yourself into something and then it gets busted in some way, then you're left cynical sometimes. He says, some people think this skeptical attitude is awful, but actually is better than the old attitude, he says. Better to be disillusioned than to be in the old illusion, which was not true. He says, as long as we have some definite idea about or some hope for the future, we cannot really be serious with the moment that exists right now. You may say, I can do it tomorrow or next year, believing that something that exists today will exist tomorrow. Even though you're not trying so hard, you expect that some promising thing will come, as long as you follow a certain way. But there's no certain way that exists permanently. There is no way set up for us. Moment after moment, we have to find our own way. Some idea of perfection or some perfect way which is set up by someone else is not the true way for us. What he's really calling on us to live in this moment intensely. Don't put anything off. You get it together right now. Do what you need to do right now. He says, each one of us must make his own true way. And when we do that, that way will express the universal way. So we can ask, what does the Shakti want of me right now? What is the most Shakti-filled way I can live this moment or this day? Every day when we wake up, we can ask, what can I do that will increase my connection to God, to the Shakti, to the Self, to the Guru? What can I do today to live more in the Spirit? Very good way of contemplating. How can I lift my life up into joy, into illumination? He says, this is the mystery. When you understand one thing through and through, you understand everything. When you try to understand everything, you will not understand anything. The best way is to understand yourself. So what is the one thing you need to understand? Yourself. And then you will understand everything. So when you try hard to make your own way, you'll help others, and you'll be helped by others. So if you walk the path of connecting deeper in yourself, the whole world will help you and you'll help the world. Before you make your own way, you cannot help anyone and no one can help you. To be independent in this true sense, we have to forget everything that we have in our mind and discover something quite new and different moment after moment. This is how we live in the world. You find this inspiring? It says just live for the Shakti. Bhavana Rakho, follow the upward shift. Live for the Shakti. So we say true understanding will come out of emptiness. When you study Buddhism, you should have a general house cleaning of your mind. Mental colonic. You must take everything out of your room and clean it thoroughly. sometimes necessary to take everything out of our physical room. He says, if it's necessary, you may bring everything back in again. You may want many things, so one by one you can bring them back. But if they are not necessary, there's no need to keep them. I went through the same process. I feel when I lived with Baba, I went through a mental house cleaning, because the life that I lived there was very disciplined and Spartan. Just a little mattress and a couple of shelves. That was my whole life. And I would, you know, wash my clothing in a bucket. And I had that all every day. Every minute was planned. It was kind of nice to do that. But also, my mind was taken apart, too. And I went through a whole crisis. All my attitudes, my political beliefs, my philosophical beliefs, my aesthetic beliefs, that was a hard one. All my values, everything was like taken apart. And then I had a realization that I could have them back, cleaning the room, and that I could bring them back, but I couldn't bring them back as if they were the gospel. I had to bring them back in a conditional way, that they were my sport rather than my master. And so I can relate to what he's saying. If it's necessary, you should bring back in the things you took from your room. But before you put something in your room, it is necessary for you to take out something. If you do not, your room will become crowded with old, useless junk. So it's a very interesting metaphor, isn't it? One after another, you will have various thoughts in your mind. And if you want to stop your thinking, you can. But as long as you have some fixed idea or are caught by some habitual way of doing things, you cannot appreciate things in their true sense. So the Zen that he teaches is very demanding. It says, don't have any preconceptions. Get rid of all your intellectual baggage and your belief systems and all the stuff that you don't experience directly. He says, if you seek for freedom, you cannot find it. Absolute freedom itself is necessary before you acquire absolute freedom. This is our practice. Our way is not always to go in one direction. Sometimes we go east, sometimes we go west. To go 1 mile to the west means to go back 1 mile to the east. Usually if you go 1 mile to the east, it is the opposite of going 1 mile to the west. But if it's possible to go 1 mile to the east, that means it's possible to go 1 mile to the west. This is freedom. So you're allowed to go 1 mile to the east as long as you allow the possibility of going 1 mile to the west. But if you say, I can only go to the east, then you're stuck in a position. Without this freedom, you cannot be concentrated on what you do. This is all very humorous, by the way, in some strange way. You may think you're concentrated on something, but before you obtain this freedom, you will have some uneasiness in what you're doing because you're bound by some idea of going east or west. Your activity is in duality or dichotomy. As long as you're caught by duality, you cannot attain absolute freedom. And you cannot concentrate. Now he's not going about concentration, his idea of concentration. Is this speaking to you? Does it inspire you in some way? Yeah? Concentration is not to try hard to watch something. Okay, our Patanjali, focus. Focus on something, try very hard to do it. He says it's not that. In Zazen, which is Zen meditation, if you try to look at one spot, you'll be tired in about 5 minutes. I remember I read some book on meditation as I was going to India, and it said, you know, meditate on a candle flame. Man, that was boring. I started thinking it's hurting my retina. And then, meditate on a spot, and the mind just goes crazy. Anyway, he says, this is not concentration. Concentration means freedom. So your effort should be directed at nothing. You should be concentrated on nothing. In Zazen practice, we say your mind should be concentrated on your breathing. But the way to keep your mind on your breathing is to forget all about yourself and just to sit and feel your breathing. If you concentrate on your breathing, you will forget yourself. And if you forget yourself, you'll be concentrated on your breathing. I don't know which is first. So actually, there's no need to try too hard to be concentrated on your breathing. Because when we start to practice, we do it very hard. No, just lightly. Just do as much as you can. If you're not too good at concentrating on your breathing, it's okay. Don't worry about it, just do a little bit. If you continue this practice, eventually you'll experience the true existence which comes from emptiness. You experience the essence. So that's his little talk. It's quite spectacular in some ways. They say, what do they say in Buddhism, that form is emptiness and emptiness is form? Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Emptiness becomes form, form is emptiness underlying that. It's exactly parallel, I would think, to Kashmir Shaivism, which says consciousness is, you know, pure formless consciousness becomes the universe and then dissolves itself back into consciousness. It's just that we, instead of saying emptiness, we say consciousness. And that emptiness is a fullness. A couple more questions if you're thoroughly confused. We do a few more short questions. It's nice. Student says, Roshi, do you think that we have any choice? For instance, I'm here at Tassajara by my choice, or am I simply here at Tassajara? That's the monastery. Suzuki Roshi, your Buddha nature brought you here to Tassajara. I think that's true. I think that in all of us, our Buddha nature brought us to want to practice, to want to understand the truth, whether we know it or not. The self, the divinity, the guru, the higher consciousness, the Buddha nature. He says, I don't think it was your choice completely. Maybe 20 or 30% is your choice. I find that really charming. You know, he's so undogmatic that he's not saying, your Buddha nature brought you here. He's saying, I don't know, maybe 20, 30% you brought yourself, and the other 70% your Buddha nature brought you. And maybe 10% your friend brought you. No? It's very cute. But most of the reason for your being here is beyond that, beyond your personal will. That we hear Buddha's teaching is because of our previous study. Wisdom seeks wisdom, and we are listening to the teaching that we have listened to under many teachers in past lives. Dogen, the head of the lineage, the ancient head of the lineage, Dogen says this, even though you feel as if your whole body is saying, I'm feeling this way 100%, that voice that now seems to cover all of your being actually is only a little tiny part of you. So the part of you that's dogmatic assertions, just a little part of you. He says, maybe I shouldn't explain so much in the traditional way. He's a little frustrated. Student says, well then, if I were to become a Buddha, would I have anything to do with it? And Suzuki Roshi says, first of all, try to forget yourself and rely on your true voice, your voiceless voice, your nonverbal voice. Listen to the tongueless teaching, we say. Don't listen to my words. Think about this. Isn't that nice? The tongueless teaching. So trying, every spiritual teaching, whatever tradition, tries to point us towards that essence. And they all say the same thing. There is an inner voice, there is an inner place of certainty, which is divine and which tells the truth. And we can't reach that place only because we're so confused and we've been so acculturated into ignorance and all kinds of things that the chatter of these other voices gets in our way. But if we become quiet, we can find that, what do they call it, the still small voice. of the self. Student, whose voice is it that we listen to? Suzuki Roshi. Sometimes Sinatra, sometimes Barry Manilow. I didn't say that. Just seeing if you're awake. Suzuki Roshi, your voice and Buddha's voice. So when you listen, that voice inside you is Buddha's voice and your voice. I like that. You sometimes think it is your voice, but it is Buddha's voice. Your thinking comes from a one-sided feeling. You think you are here. You think that you are Joe or Mary. But actually, it's not so, not at all. I think I'm Suzuki. But if someone calls me Suzuki, I feel very funny. Oh, is this Suzuki? The first reaction is, no, I'm not Suzuki. Student. So that's the end of that conversation. That he's a little uncomfortable in admitting that he's this person, because there's something more. That's one-sided thinking. And finally, student, this is great too. Roshi, I may put my palms together in gassho, and someone may look at me and say, oh, that is a good gassho. Gassho. Is that like this? Gassho? Do they do gassho in Tibetan Buddhism? Gassho. He says, so somebody looks at me and says, oh, good gassho. But there may be a cold heart behind it. So this student's very self-critical. Even so, people used to do this around Baba. That they'd say when they pranam to the guru, their heart's not in it. And Baba would say the same thing Suzuki Roshi says. Suzuki Roshi says, cold heart or warm heart is not the question. Is it still a good gassho, student says. Suzuki Roshi says, perfect. Just do it and shut up. Don't be so self-critical. So do it. It'll eventually be a good gassho if it's not one now. So Baba would say that just do what's appropriate. Don't be so self-critical. So what do you think? The nadis, the subtle nerves in the brain, have been going in one direction. They become one-sided. And so when you hear a great teaching, it caresses it in the opposite way. It makes you think in a new way, and that's very helpful, because when you think in a new way, it opens channels and it lets Shakti move. So let's meditate. And we're going to meditate for about 10 minutes. I'm going to do a little what I call the Shiva process express. I'll lead into an express form of Shiva process, and then we can just sit. Okay, so let's close our eyes and become present. Become aware of your inner being. Bring your attention to the navel area. Feel the feeling in the navel area. Be aware of the feeling. Does it feel pleasant or unpleasant? Does it feel tense or relaxed? Bring the thought into the navel. I let go, I relax. I open up. I let go of tension. And bring your mind up to the heart area. Feel the feeling in the heart area. You might feel happy or sad. You might feel blocked or open. Bring in the thought, I give my love. give my love. My essential nature is to love. I give my love. Now bring the attention up to the throat. Does that feel blocked or open? When the throat is open, you can communicate your thoughts and your feelings in a perfect way that's uplifting and joyful. It's very hard to attain that. So say to yourself, I communicate the truth. I communicate the truth with kindness. I communicate the truth with kindness. Now we bring our attention up to the third eye, command center, the intellectual center. A lot of times we feel confusion, darkness, we don't understand things. But inside of us there's a place where we understand things perfectly, where there are good and true answers. So say to yourself, I open up my intellect to the truth. I open to the truth. I'm unafraid of the truth. I open to it. The great light of consciousness exists in my third eye. Okay, now we'll meditate for about 7 minutes and we'll just sit and let that truth uncover itself within us. So once again, with great love and respect, I welcome you all with all my heart. Sadhguru Nath Maharaj Ki Jai. Meditate on the voice of the Buddha and on the truth within.